Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
There is no video recording of the Big Bang, but in a sense, there is audio. That's a simulation of the low, deep noise emitted as the universe was born. You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Lauren Silverman, sitting in this week for Chris Boyd. My guest this hour wants to know what existed before the Big Bang. Alan Lightman is a physicist, writer, and professor. His most recent article, What Came Before the Big Bang, is in Harper's Magazine January issue. Alan Lightman, welcome to Think.
Nice to be here, Lauren.
So could you have picked a more difficult question to answer?
Well, I think there are other difficult questions, but this is certainly one of the most and one that we may not know the answer to for quite a while.
That certainly seems to be the case. So do you know what that sound was, or if we have any idea what the sound was of the universe being born?
Well, I've never heard that sound before. Obviously, it's simulated. There were no sound detectors there at the beginning. But it might be the translation of the cosmic background radiation, which is a form of light, which we know is left over from the Big Bang. It might have been the conversion of that into sound.
And so what was that exactly? I'm sorry, that if it were that conversion, what was that light, those waves?
We know that when the universe was a few hundred thousand years old, which is, of course, sounds like pretty old, but it's still, when you consider the universe is almost 14 billion years old now, it's near the infancy. Maybe when the universe was about 6 months old, in other words, emitted that there was radiation, light, of course, the light that we see is a form of radiation, but there was radiation at frequencies that the eye couldn't see that began expanding through space. And that was actually one of the ways that we first proved the Big Bang model. We detected that radiation in the early 1960s. And I'm thinking that sound that you played was just the sonic version of that radiation.
Sort of like the universe crying, the first cry of the baby, say, at six
yes.
months old.
And you notice that the frequency of that went down with time,
yeah.
Which is what happens as the universe expands. All of the frequencies go down in pitch, just like when you expand a tire, the pressure gets less.
Interesting. So I love this because you start your article in Harper's with a scene from 1931, when Einstein was about to make a very big announcement. Can you describe that scene?
Well, it took place in a little library in Pasadena, the observatory there. I think it was the Mount Wilson Observatory. And Einstein, for years, had been resisting the idea of a universe in motion. He thought that the universe was static, just like Aristotle and Isaac Newton did, and I think even in Christianity, the universe is static once it's created. That is, it doesn't move. And Einstein had been confronted with some experimental evidence that the galaxies are not at rest, that they're moving away from each other, and they're doing it in a particular way to suggest that the whole universe is expanding like blowing up a balloon. In 1931, at this moment in the library where he had various scientists and astronomers, physicists and astronomers gathered around him, he basically recanted his static model of the universe and accepted the Big Bang model. And, of course, because Einstein was the most famous scientist in the world at that time, whatever words came out of his mouth were had a lot of weight.
And before that, he had, you write that he'd called the idea of this expanding universe abominable.
Yes. He thought it was a ridiculous idea. There were a couple of other theoretical physicists who had proposed an expanding universe, which he thought were ridiculous ideas. And even the first observational evidence he dismissed. But he finally was swayed by the evidence. Even though Einstein was a very philosophical man and based a lot of his original ideas on philosophy and aesthetics, he was ultimately a scientist, which meant that he was ultimately swayed by the observational evidence. Oftentimes we prefer that nature behave one way or another, but if we're scientists, we have to ultimately yield to the facts, to the observed facts, and that's what Einstein did in 1931.
And so what was the observational evidence that he couldn't ignore?
The evidence was that all of the galaxies were moving away from each other in all directions, and they were moving at a speed proportional to their distance. That is, galaxies twice away, twice as far from us, were moving twice as fast. And that's the result that you get if space itself is expanding. If you paint dots on a balloon, and each one of those dots represents a galaxy, and you begin blowing up the balloon, then from the point of view of any one dot, all the other dots are moving away from it, and they're moving at speeds proportional to their distance. That is, a dot that's a million light years away, if the balloon size doubles, it will move to 2 million light years away. But a galaxy that was 2 million light years away, when you double the size of the balloon, will move to 4 million light years away. So it has moved twice as far in the same amount of time. And that's why this special result of velocity being proportional to distance means that that space itself is expanding, like the surface of a balloon. And that's what we believe about the universe today.
So if that's the case, then did it all begin in this idea of the Big Bang really start with a shriveled up sort of balloon, something very small?
Right. That's right. If you let the air out of the balloon, or you play this movie backwards, all the dots get closer and closer together. And eventually there's a particular time in the past, a particular moment in the past, when all of the galaxies were on top of each other. And you can calculate when that moment was by looking at the rate at which the universe is expanding now. You can just extrapolate backwards in time. And physicists and astronomers have done that, and they have calculated that moment in time when everything was crushed together in a single point was about 13.8 billion years ago, and that we call that T equals zero. We also call it the beginning of the universe. We call it the Big Bang.
Which is so interesting. Now, at that moment when the universe was just this tiny, tiny thing, do you think that there were other universes that were about to emerge?
Well, we don't know that, and something we will never know. But the best thinking of theoretical physicists is, yes, there were other universes which were also having their own Big Bangs, not all at the same time. And, of course, when you talk about time at the beginning, it becomes a nebulous and vague concept, because time may have been created at the same moment that the universe was created. So there would have been no before, because time didn't exist. It's very difficult for us human beings with our experience with the world to think about things that didn't happen in time. We always think about a before and an after. But theoretical physicists have gotten used to thinking about very bizarre, abstract concepts, and the absence of time is one of them.
And the numbers are very difficult to comprehend. You write that the temperature at this moment when this balloon, so to put it, was shriveled up, where the galaxies were all on top of each other, mm-hmm. the temperature was nearly a million, billion, billion, billion degrees.
Yes, we can't possibly fathom that, but we can deal with it in our mathematics. And I would say that one thing that we've learned from modern science is there are a lot of concepts that modern science deals with that cannot be fathomed from daily experience. I mean, the most obvious is just that there are all of these electromagnetic waves traveling through space that our eyes can't see. There's radio waves, there are X-rays. These are all similar to light waves, that they're just at frequencies that our eyes can't see. So we have discovered in the last, especially in the last century, a whole realm of reality that is beyond human sense perception.
Is it fair to say that physicists, including you, don't know, have no idea what came before the Big Bang?
Well, I wouldn't say that we have no idea. We have theoretical speculations. And in fact, we know what we would need to know in order to determine that. We need to know how gravity behaves under very, very high densities. It's an area of physics called quantum gravity. And we believe that maybe in the next 50 years that we will have a theory of quantum gravity. We don't have that theory at the moment. So what physicists do is they speculate, but it's not pie-in-the-sky speculation. It's speculation based on other physics that we do know and based upon mathematical consistency. But I think in general you're certainly right that we don't really know what happened before the Big Bang. And we will never know for sure, of course, but I think within the next 50 years we will have a much better idea than we do now.
What do you like about theorizing about this and testing the question about what came before the Big Bang?
Well, I think it's one of the deepest questions that we human beings can ask about the cosmos. Life is pretty baffling. Our consciousness is baffling. What is it? Our awareness, our self-awareness. What is it to be alive? And when we begin asking questions like that, we start thinking much beyond ourselves. When we look up at the night sky, what are all those points of light? Does space go on forever, or does it have some outer boundary? Or is it somehow finite but without a boundary, like the surface of a balloon? All of these questions are far beyond our daily experience with the world. But human beings are curious creatures, and we want to know. We want to understand. And understanding how we got here and how our ancestors got here and how the Earth got here and how the sun got here and how the whole universe got here, it seems to me that those are the deepest questions we can ask.
Yeah. Well, we'll get to more of that. You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Lauren Silverman, in today for Chris Boyd. You can join our conversation about something that happened 14 billion years ago or so. With ideas or questions, call 800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. We'll be back with more from physicist and author Alan Lightman after a short break.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Spring registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, literature, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
About 14 billion years ago, the universe started with a bang. Cosmologists have been trying to describe, with some success, what happened after that moment for thousands of years. But what happened before? You're listening to Think. I'm Lauren Silverman, in today for Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Alan Lightman, an astrophysicist teaching at MIT and author of Einstein's Dreams. Alan Lightman, does the way that the universe looks today provide any clues as to what happened before the Big Bang?
Yes, it does. And one of the biggest clues is the high degree of order of the universe that we see. That is, if you take all of the galaxies that we see and you look at them from a large enough distance, the universe looks very smooth, like the grains of sand on a beach when viewed from 100 feet away. It didn't have to be that way. The galaxies could have been far more clumped together than they are. And that smoothness, in turn, translates to an unusual degree of smoothness when the universe started 14 billion years ago. So that's a very powerful clue. Physicists have a way of talking about the direction of time, which is related to smoothness. That is, the forward direction of time, or the future, points in the direction of decreasing smoothness, decreasing order, more disorder. So the forward direction of time is in the direction of movement from order to disorder. So the fact that we have a very clear direction of time in our universe today, it's very easy to distinguish between a cup falling off a table and shattering versus the reverse happening, the cup jumping off a floor and reforming itself to become a whole cup. The fact that we have a very clear idea of the forward direction of time means that our universe, that's related to the smoothness that we see in the universe today, which is related to the smoothness of when it was created. And in fact, one of the leading theories about how the universe started relates to that smoothness. It says that the universe was existed before the Big Bang, but it was contracting before the Big Bang. So it was contracting from a large size before the Big Bang, reached a minimum size, and then began expanding after the Big Bang. And since there's more disorder with larger sizes, basically because you can put things in more random places with larger sizes, that means that the smoothness of the universe was at a maximum when the universe was at its smallest size. And then time would point in both directions away from that point of smallest size, away from the Big Bang. The forward direction of time would point away from the Big Bang in both directions.
Huh.
So if you were a subatomic creature living at the Big Bang, you would see arrows pointing in both directions, and you would be very confused about the direction of time.
I could imagine being very confused if I were there, or even it's a bit confusing here. So let me just see if I understand. I'm picturing, and I know this isn't exactly right, but a stack of coins or something, you know, stacked on top of each other, and that is an ordered object, and then mm-hmm. it all dispersing across the floor. And you letting it sit there and people are walking around and kicking it around and it gets more disordered. So, but it isn't,
yes.
But you say it's still ordered today.
It's still ordered, but it's much less ordered than it was at the Big Bang.
Mm.
Tomorrow it would be even more disordered.
Mm.
So there was an extremely high degree of order at the Big Bang with disorder increasing in both directions. This particular theory that I've sketched out where time has always existed, where the universe was collapsing before the Big Bang and expanding since the Big Bang. This particular theory is called two-headed time. It has been proposed by a physicist at Caltech named Sean Carroll, collaborating with a physicist at MIT named Alan Guth. And it's called two-headed time because time points in both directions away from the Big Bang. I remember there's this scene in The Wizard of Oz where they're looking for the Emerald Palace, and they come to a crossroads in the street, and their arrows pointing in all directions.
Yes.
Towards. So it's sort of like that situation. Once you move away from the Big Bang, either further into the past or further into the future, time takes on a very clear direction.
Interesting. Okay, well, if people want to join and ask questions and bounce off ideas, you can call 800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Let's go to the phones now. Let's go to Mac in Frisco.
Good afternoon. If you take an explosive device and you put it on top of something like high like a flagpole and you explode it and you take a picture of the shockwave, what you'll see until it hits the ground is a spherical shockwave. So if the Big Bang was like that, does that mean that, and using your balloon analogy, does that mean that everybody's on the top of the balloon, on the skin of the balloon, and there's nothing in the middle?
Mm-hmm.
Or,
right.
You know,
yes.
Is that what we're saying?
Yes, we're saying that everybody lives on the surface of the balloon, and the reason why the your analogy of the bomb exploding on the top of a flagpole is not exactly right, although it's partly right, is because with the bomb, there's a space around the flagpole to which the explosive material is expanding into. But with the Big Bang, and if you now think about the balloon metaphor, all of reality and existence is on the surface of the balloon. So we're actually one dimension lower than the actual three-dimensionality of space. We're using a one-dimension lower analogy. But if everyone is on the surface of the balloon, then there's no outside. The interior of the balloon is not part of your reality. Only the surface of the balloon is part of your reality.
So where does dark energy or dark matter come into theories such as two-headed time and the creation of the universe?
Well, dark energy and dark matter don't come in specifically with the theory of two-headed time. They come in more in understanding the parameters of our universe today. Dark energy was discovered in the late 1990s. It acts as if it were anti-gravity, and instead of pulling everything together, pushes everything apart. It's like putting your foot on the accelerator pedal of a car. And so the universe, the galaxies are accelerating away from each other because of the dark energy. But that's really just a modification of the Big Bang picture. It doesn't fundamentally alter the Big Bang picture. It doesn't fundamentally alter the discussions of what may have come before the Big Bang.
Let's go back to the phones. Let's go to Larry in Dallas. Hi, Larry.
Hi. This is an incredible discussion. I appreciate you doing it. I have a close friend who is at Rice University. He's an astrophysicist, and he can't explain something that perhaps you can. He's doing work on something called superclusters, which are humongous clusters of galaxies which show an asymmetry in the Big Bang, and according to him, is in conflict with some aspects of the Big Bang theory. And I'm wondering if you could comment on that.
Interesting. What do you think, Alan Lightman?
Well, to my knowledge, superclusters are not in conflict with the Big Bang. They represent inhomogeneities. That is, they're sort of like disturbances of the sand on the beach. But I would claim that
clumps of cat litter, perhaps, if you
like
have.
Clumps of cat litter. That's even better. Or maybe if a cat peed on the sand. But if you look at the universe on a large enough scale, even the superclusters tend to smooth out. That is, if you take a large enough volume of space, including many superclusters, then any volume of space looks like any other volume of space. We do know that there were inhomogeneities, non-smoothnesses in the early universe, which are the what of the seeds out of which galaxies form and clusters of galaxies and superclusters of galaxies. So we do expect some of that to be happening.
Now, so we mentioned the idea of two-headed time. Is it possible, and in that idea, there was time before the Big Bang, just as there is time after the Big Bang. Mm-hmm. Is it possible that our universe and everything in it arose spontaneously from nothing?
Yes. I can tell that you have read the article very closely, so thank you for that, Lauren.
Yes.
Yes, the other major competing theory to two-headed time is that everything, including time, began at t equals zero, the Big Bang event. And this would have been during a regime of the universe when the entire universe was smaller than an atom. When I say the entire universe, I mean the entire observable universe, which goes to about 10 billion light years out. The entire observable universe was packed within a region smaller than an atom, if you can possibly wrap your head around that. And at that time, at that moment, quantum physics was very important. Because quantum physics deals with the subatomic world, and among other things, it shows how a particle can be in two places at the same time. But when the entire universe was smaller than the size of an atom, then quantum physics applied to the universe as a whole. And according to quantum physics, matter can materialize literally out of nothing. We've actually verified this in the laboratory. And so according to quantum physics, it's possible for the entire universe to have materialized from nothing. Time would not have existed before this point, and even using the word before is inaccurate because before implies a temporal context. So the entire universe came into being or always was, or however you want to say it, there was a moment of smallest size of the universe and no prior moments. That might be a better way of putting it.
Who was the first person to come up with this idea, which I can imagine was pretty controversial, or is?
Well, there's a guy named Trion. I can't remember his first name, a physicist who came up with the idea in the 70s. There were a couple of Russian physicists who came up with the idea in the 70s. The person who is given most of the credit because he developed it the most thoroughly was Alexander Vilenkin, who is a Ukrainian physicist who has been in the U.S. since 1976. He's now a professor of physics at Tufts University. And Vilenkin was the first person to fully develop this idea of the universe materializing out of nothing, including the creation of time.
And you write in the article that this scientist, Vilenkin, worked when he was in the Soviet Union as a night watchman at a zoo.
Yes. Well, he was he had finished college, had applied to graduate school in the West, and his visa was revoked. And he believes that that was because of the KGB, because of various views that he had, possibly slightly political. I'm not sure. He was also Jewish and thinks that that might have been a reason. At any rate, his visa to the U.S. was revoked, He was not able to come to the graduate school in the U.S., so instead he worked for a while as a night watchman at a zoo, which he tells me gave him plenty of time to think cosmologically. I don't know.
Yeah.
Maybe looking at the lions and tigers and bears. But anyway, he eventually did get a visa to the U.S., and I believe that he got his Ph.D. in biophysics, which was very far from cosmology. This would have been in the late 1970s, and he tells me that cosmology was not a respectable field to work in at that time, that a lot of physics departments thought it was too speculative, too far out. So he came to cosmology only after getting his Ph.D. in biophysics.
And are there many clashes between the people who believe that in this idea of two-headed time versus the people who believe the universe arose from nothing? We just have a few seconds, but I would like to hear.
Well, first of all, it's a very small field. It's a tiny field. The number of people who work in this area of the very, very beginning, which you can call quantum cosmology, is only a very small number. I think the physicists, or I wouldn't describe them as clashing. I think they have different views. There's a feeling of excitement. They're all working on something very strange and mysterious and wonderful and beautiful. So I would say it's more of a feeling of camaraderie. Since there is no ultimate theory of quantum gravity yet, all of this work is highly theoretical and somewhat speculative. So everyone takes it with a little bit of a grain of salt.
You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Lauren Silverman in today for Chris Boyd. We'll get back very shortly with Alan Lightman talking about the creation of the universe. And we'll get to your questions. If you have them, call 800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. We'll be back with more from Alan Lightman and the Big Bang after a short break.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Spring registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, literature, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Lauren Silverman, in for Chris Boyd. We're talking with writer and physicist Alan Lightman about the creation of the universe. His article, What Came Before the Big Bang, is in the January issue of Harper's Magazine. Alan Lightman, if the universe had a distinct beginning, like the second theory you mentioned, does that mean it will have a distinct end?
Not necessarily. But there is a fair amount of observational evidence to suggest that the universe will keep expanding forever. That it will not reach maximum size and then start contracting, which is a belief that was held some years ago. We now think the universe will keep expanding forever. What will happen is that life may come to an end, because we know that all of the stars in our universe, unlike what Shakespeare and Aristotle and others thought, that our stars are totally material. They burn. They make energy by burning nuclear fuel. Each star is like a lot of nuclear bombs going off continuously. And eventually they will exhaust all of their nuclear fuel. They will burn out and become dim and cold. And so that is the fate of all of the stars in our universe. And we think that we know that, at least on Earth, that all life on Earth is driven in one way or another by the heat and light of our sun. And so when all of the stars burn out, it's very likely that life will end as well. So the ending of our universe that we predict right now is just a gradual dimming of all of the stars, and space will get very, very cold and dark.
Not a very bright picture of the future, but it's very far from today, I imagine.
Very far from today, billions of years from today.
Let's go to the phones. Some more questions here. Let's go to Juan in Fort Worth.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, I'm good.
Dr. Brightman, I have a question. Earlier you used the example of a balloon exploding, mm-hmm. and you said that we're aware of our reality because we're on the surface of that balloon. So what is that reality underneath it? Is it alternate realities, or is it time that has passed? And if so, does that open the possibility of actually of humans going backwards in time?
No, the picture of the balloon is a metaphor, and it's like all metaphors, it's not exact. And in this case, we are compressing our three-dimensional space down to two-dimensional space for the purposes of the illustration. So I'm imagining that instead of space being three-dimensional, it's two-dimensional. We are two-dimensional creatures. There is no third dimension for us, and we live on the surface of a balloon. And I'm just using that as a way to picture it. It doesn't mean that literally we are living on the surface of a balloon. But if your universe is two-dimensional, then there is no interior of the balloon. That's where the analogy to our universe breaks down. The correct description, which is very hard to picture, is a three-dimensional surface or a four-dimensional sphere in four-dimensional space. And we can't picture that, but that would be the exact analogy. But the idea is that you are in a finite but bounded space, and that the space is stretching with the distance between any two points increasing. And that is perhaps a better way of thinking about it.
Hmm. Now, let's go back to the phones because there's so many questions that are good, and I want to get to some of them. Sierra in Dallas, are you there?
What, Sierra? Are you talking to me?
Yeah, hi, are you there?
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
Of course.
A doctor, I have a question. As you were saying, I believe you said that the beginning, there's no beginning and no end, no forward, no backward, but you said it would start with a tiny atom. I want to know, where did the tiny atom come from?
Great question.
Well, let's talk about the two-headed time model with no beginning and no end. So time is infinite in both directions. The universe has always been here. It was in a contracting phase, getting smaller and smaller up until 14 billion years ago. At 14 billion years ago, it reached a minimum size, like a slinky that you drop on the floor, and it gets a minimum compaction when it hits the floor and then bounces up again. And then after, in the last 14 billion years, the universe has been expanding. Well, at that minimum size, which we call T equals zero, even though time existed before T equals zero, at that minimum size, the entire observable universe was smaller than the size of an atom. So there was no creation event in the two-headed time model. The universe was always here. There was always matter and energy. Nothing had to be created. It's just that things were contracting before the Big Bang and expanding after the Big Bang. In the second model that I discussed, the second hypothesis, where the universe and time began at the Big Bang, in that model, the energy and matter of the universe was created out of nothing. And we have actually seen that happen in the laboratory, that single particles can be created out of nothing. And you may ask, well, how can you produce energy out of nothing? Well, you start off with zero energy when there's nothing. Then you create positive energy and matter. But that is counterbalanced by a negative energy of gravity. Gravity has negative energy. So that if you add the negative energy of gravity to the positive energy of matter, you get zero. So you started with zero and you continue with zero. You haven't violated the conservation of energy. But according to quantum physics, you can create matter out of nothing. And as I said, we've actually observed this happen, but at a very tiny scale in the laboratory with single subatomic particles. What's hard to wrap your mind around is that the whole universe could have been created that way. And as I said earlier, there are things that modern physics discusses, writes equations for, sees verified in the laboratory, which are very, very far from our daily experience and so seem strange to us.
Where does the idea of religion and intelligent design fit into any of these explanations for what sparked the Big Bang?
Well, if you are a believer in intelligent design, then you believe that there was a creator. And there are actually some physicists who have this view. The creator designed the universe so that it would have the right properties to create life. We know that the universe requires very special properties to allow life to emerge. And we can imagine lots of universes which would be mathematically self-consistent, but which would not have stars and galaxies and atoms and life in them. So you can subscribe to the belief, and science cannot prove this wrong, that there was an intelligent creator that designed the universe. Most scientists do not hold that belief. Most scientists hold the belief that there are many, many universes out there, which we call the multiverse, with many different properties. The vast majority of them do not have the right properties to allow the emergence of life, but a small fraction of them do have the right properties to allow the emergence of life. And by definition, we live in such a universe because otherwise we wouldn't be here to talk about it.
So I was fascinated to read that the idea of the multiverse or the many universes mm-hmm. isn't something new. It goes back to the Middle Ages or before.
Well, it does. There are a lot of ideas in science that go back to early times. That doesn't mean that those early thinkers had a grasp of the idea the way that we do today or even thought about it in the same way. But the idea of many different universes is a philosophical and theological idea as well as a scientific idea. So it's not surprising that you would find some early thinkers who had that concept.
Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Paige in Tyler.
Hi,
Paige.
Hello.
What's your question?
So I was actually just thinking about the things that you were presently speaking about. I am a Christian, and all the things you're saying about how the universe began at a single point and is then expanding completely goes along with all Christian belief and definitely mm-hmm. aligns with that kind of theology. And I just want to address that because earlier in the program you said that Christians didn't believe in that. I just want to say that how you're addressing the universe in such a beautiful, poetic way, because it really is, completely goes along with that Christian worldview.
Well, if I did say that Christians didn't have that belief, I misstated or I didn't mean to say that. I know that, for example, say, Thomas Aquinas went head-to-head with Aristotle on just this point, and Aristotle believed that the universe was eternal, that it had always existed, as in the two-headed time model. And, of course, St. Thomas Aquinas took the biblical, the Christian biblical version that the universe was created by God at a certain moment in time. So I certainly do accept and acknowledge your comment.
Do you think Alan Lightman will ever know what came before, if we can use this term, before the Big Bang? What is modern technology helping us understand?
I don't think it's going to be technology that helps us understand that question. I think it's going to be theoretical work. We're never going to be able to create conditions in the laboratory that come close to simulating the conditions of density and temperature near the Big Bang. But we do have some theories in physics right now, including so-called string theory, which may ultimately produce a grand theory of quantum gravity, is what we call it, understanding the behavior of gravity at enormously high densities near the Big Bang. And we do believe that when we have such a theory, and it's not infinitely far off in the future, I think most physicists would say we would have such a theory in 50 years or so, that we will be able to make fairly reliable theoretical calculations of what happened at t equals zero. We will never be able to prove the truth of those calculations by experimental observation.
Now, I know you value a good mystery, and there's sort of a beauty to exploring these questions that we can't seem to answer. Do you really want to know what happened?
I think I would like to know. I think there will always be questions in science, scientific questions, and I'm not even addressing the philosophical and theological questions. I think there will always be questions in science that we will not know the answer to. And I think that that's a good thing, because it's the mystery, I think, that propels us, that drives us to search and learn more and more. Just as Vasco da Gama was driven to explore and sail across the world, I think that it's those mysteries that will drive us forward.
You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Lauren Silverman, in today for Chris Boyd. We've been talking with physicist and author Alan Lightman, who most recently wrote What Came Before the Big Bang for Harper's Magazine. Alan Lightman, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me on your show, Lauren.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Knavy. Lindsay Knecht is associate producer, with help on the phones today from Kristen Taylor. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can contact us via email, think@kera.org. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.